ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Before we begin today's program, I want to acknowledge that the conversation you're about to hear contains discussion of traumatic historical events, including massacres, the Stolen Generations, and violence against First Nations peoples.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
In fact, the whole experience was life-changing of doing this journey. Not to push away the shame and the sorrow of the past that we're part of, but to accept it as actually part of who I am. Not just accept it, actually, but, you know, sit with it. This is part of who I am. Deal with it. Because once you've done that, instead of pushing it away, that then opens the door to going forward into an Australia where perhaps at last we can find justice and an honourable way to move forward together.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt, and it's great to be back with you for another year. In fact, my 10th year as host of the program, if you can believe it. It's been a tremendous privilege to be in this position, and I look forward to sharing more conversations, stories, and perspectives from the most influential and beloved people within the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. Much has been made of the importance of truth-telling and the need to gain a broader understanding of our country's shared past. Picture a room with people ready to confront uncomfortable truths, to sit with the weight of history, to listen without judgment to what First Nations people have to say. But who does the truth-telling? Who listens? And are we prepared to be uncomfortable enough to change? From the bend of the creek to the top of the mountain, from the places our elders told us not to go after dark, to the family records some would rather destroy than share, truth-telling is a multifaceted process. To explore this concept further, I thought we'd feature a conversation which really resonated with me because of its rawness and honesty. Moderated by Professor Robin Quiggin, the UTS Pro Vice-Chancellor for Indigenous Leadership and Engagement, we'll hear from four remarkable voices. Kate Grenville, a celebrated author who took a deeply personal journey to confront her family's colonial past. Lorena Allam, a multiple Walkley Award-winning journalist descended from the Uwalari and Gamilaroi people of northwest New South Wales, who reminds us that truth-telling isn't activism, it's reporting. Professor Lyndon Coombs, also Uwalari and Director of Jumbana Research. His work has transformed how major institutions confront their racist legacies. And Dr. Mariko Smith, whose incredible work at the Australian Museum transforms once anonymous artefacts back into beloved ancestors with names, families and stories. Here's moderator, Professor Robin Quiggin.
So we're honoured today to have Lorena Allam, Kate Grenville, Lyndon Coombs and Mariko Smith. We'll invite each of them to come and speak for a few moments on their particular work and then engage in a panel discussion. So I'd like to invite to the stage Kate, Lorena, Mariko and Lyndon.
Thank you.
We'll begin with Lorena and who's going to say a few words about her work. Over to you, Lorena. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Yama, everybody. Thank you for coming today to hear this very important talk. I'm looking forward to hearing from my fellow panellists as well. As Robin said, I'm a Gamilaroi Uwalari woman, small but mighty nation from northwest New South Wales. I joined Jumbana quite recently after a long career in the media at the ABC for 27 years and then The Guardian. Most of that time, I think, has been involved in truth-telling in some form or another, as is the job of a journalist. So I come from an industry background, so I'm learning the ropes, learning to find time to think and process about the concepts of truth-telling and to help mob do that truth-telling. So I acknowledge my ancestors and elders, I acknowledge the Gadigal people and their ancestors, and to mob who are here today, thank you for coming. I acknowledge your ancestors too, because they're always with us. So As I say, truth-telling is supposed to be what journalism is all about, to challenge the status quo, to ask questions, to not take things at face value. Journalism, as the old saying goes, is meant to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I think Indigenous journalists often provide the historical and social context for what our people experience. We know that this context is often missing from mainstream reporting about our people and our communities and our history. I mean, for example, bringing an understanding of Stolen Generations history, as Robin talked about before, and what intergenerational trauma looks like in a community that's been destroyed by child removals is really fundamental to reporting on a story about the rising rates of out-of-home care. It is not activist journalism. It is reporting. And we meet the ethical and editorial standards that are required of us as journalists, just as every other reporter in the newsrooms where we work. In fact, I would say that our role is even more challenging because we are accountable to our communities in all the ways that non-Indigenous journalists are not. And if we get it wrong or misrepresent the issue, our people are often the toughest critics, and so they should be. In the Australian context, I think of truth-telling as doing the work necessary to build a truer picture of history. This country was taken by violence and killing. Thousands of First Nations people were killed in the name of colonisation, and I want to issue an apology for talking about such traumatic things today, and I apologise if it causes you distress. Those crimes have never been fully accounted for, and in many instances the accounts of the killings have been hidden. The code of silence has lasted far too long, and it's time to break that silence. I mean, I genuinely believe that non-Indigenous Australians need to do this work more than we do, because we broadly know our history. We know what happened to our people. Our elders told us that story because we didn't get it at school. They tell us what happened where, you know, the bend of the creek, the top of the mountain, the places not to go after dark. We were never afforded the luxury of ignorance about this history, and I think it's time for non-Indigenous Australians to catch up, because we've been waiting for them down the track to come up and meet us. And I think our shared history will be enriched by it when they do this work. We may yet come to an agreed truth, a version of our past that values all the stories of what took place, so that we can make room for, as Robin mentioned, new heroes, the people who fought back, the people who resisted, the people who refused to be silent. They're all there in our history books, and we haven't given them enough time and attention. And part of that process should happen now. My current work for UTS is in researching how we might imagine truth-telling, exploring questions like truth-seeking. What is that? What is it? Who does it? What are we looking for when we talk about truth-seeking? Where do we look for it? Truth-telling, what are we doing it for? Who are we doing it for? Who does the telling? And most importantly, and I think the hardest part, is truth-listening. Who are we talking to, and are they prepared to really listen? Because it will make you very uncomfortable and will probably change what you do. One of the big projects I worked on at The Guardian was The Killing Times, which was an adaptation, a collaboration with the University of Newcastle to sort of bring their massacre map to a mainstream audience through journalism. And I think the whole point of that was to say to people, well, now you know, this is how your country was settled. Now you know, you have to do something with that information. You can't just pretend it didn't happen any longer. What is the most meaningful way to do truth-telling? Are big investigations important, big performative inquiries, or is it more of an interpersonal thing? Because I think, having witnessed quite a bit of that in recent years, the interpersonal stuff, the coming together of descendants, is so powerful and so, in many ways, so much more meaningful. But whatever way happens, it has to be led by First Nations people. There are challenges, obviously, the ones who are resistant to the truth, the ones who are in denial, the ones who don't want the stories told, the ones who might destroy the family records rather than hand them over to a library. There are many families out there grappling with this stuff. Generations, one generation wanting to tell the truth, the older generations wanting to stay in that comfortable place of denial. But I think We need to overcome all that fear of approbation to tell the fuller picture of the nation. We shouldn't leave that work to our children and grandchildren. I think they'll have enough to be doing, getting on with. And I genuinely believe that the one thing we all have in common is this land we walk upon, that we live on, and the country holds all these stories. The country doesn't lie, and we need to let country speak and listen without judgment to what it has to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lorena. That's I think the Killing Times, that collaboration between journalism, media and university, the research that was done around massacres is incredibly powerful. And if you haven't seen it, it's a really amazing work to look back on to see the historically based mapping and storytelling of massacres, one of the real stories that we don't tell easily in this country. And thinking about storytelling, there is possibly nothing more classically storytelling than the art of the book, the novel, the published work. So we are really grateful to also be joined by Kate Grenville. Kate is one of Australia's most celebrated writers, and her most recent work, Unsettled, A Journey Through Time and Place. In that book, she grapples with what it means to be a descendant of colonisation in Australia. So over to you, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Lorena, for that. That really pierced my heart, actually, that knowledge that we non-Aboriginal Australians have such a duty there. I'd like to begin by just acknowledging the fact that I live and work and write my last few books on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation back in Naam, which might also be called Melbourne. And I pay tribute and honour all those elders, present, past and emerging. And I'm honoured to be here on this platform today. I'm really honoured to be part of this conversation, and I thank you all very much. When I was growing up, which was the 50s, the dark ages, Aboriginal people were not mentioned very much. But my mother was unusual in many ways, and one of the ways is that she was conscious of them even then. So every time our family went on a camping trip or a picnic to some beautiful spot, at some point she would look around, she made sure I was listening, she would look around and she would say, "This must have been paradise for the Aboriginal people before we came along." Now, I was only young, but it set up a kind of ripple of unease, which I realise now, at the end of my life, has been rippling through my life all those years. And in a way, it was a great gift. My family has been in this country for five generations, which for non-Aboriginal people is quite a while. For all the others on this panel, it is a puffedeenth of the blink of an eye. They were convicts, they were publicans, they were selectors. One of them, unfortunately, was a squatter. What they all had in common was that they all took land from Aboriginal people. Now, Mum, as well as reminding me that we were on Aboriginal land, also gave me the great gift of a family story about each of those five generations. And in a way, when I look back at all the books I've written, they have all been circling that uneasiness that I felt then, the theme of how we should think about our forebears, how to address that unsettledness, and above all, how to tell the truth about it. So the project that I have just completed, I suppose, although actually it feels like the beginning of a project, but anyway, this bit of it's finished, the book called Unsettled. Having written several books that were circling this subject of how to be a non-Indigenous Australian, basically, was this time to do it through a very personal journey. I decided to take a road trip through all the places that my family stories had happened on, all in New South Wales, starting at Wiseman's Ferry, just up the road, and ending at Gyra, up in the so-called New England Tablelands. Gosh, the names we give places. So what I wanted to do was to stand on the exact spot that my ancestors had taken, to name it to myself as taken, as stolen, simply to sit with that truth and basically see where that might lead me. It was a kind of do-it-yourself truth-telling. I started it, I started the writing of it after the referendum, and there was a kind of white-hot rage in me that something, some incredible act of generosity had been rebuffed. And so this was my way, given that our leaders were turning their back on truth-telling, this was my way of doing it, a very personal, individual thing. It was, of course, challenging. Lorena, you used the word confronting, and that's the least of it. This is, when you look at our past, it is a vast, violent crime, really, done by people like my ancestors, although I never have found out whether they were actually part of the violence, but whether or not they were complicit. At the very best, they turned a blind eye. And that violent past shapes the present, and that's partly why it's so important. We have to get it right. So that's really hard to own as a heritage. It means that you have to confront feelings of shame, deep sorrow, mourning, confusion. They're all really difficult feelings to allow in. And we're all quite good, as I think Freud told us, at pushing them away, pushing them down underneath, back into the unconscious. So what I found was that standing on the land was the way to meet that challenge. My instinct about that was correct. The land, without being too kind of magical about it, the land really does hold the stories. You look around and you are conscious of the realities of the past and the stories. And in many cases, it bears witness. Once you have done some learning, you can see on the landscape the marks of what was there before. So it bears witness in a very concrete way. I felt that the land was my companion as I went through this very difficult journey. It gave me a quiet space. I was on my own, where I could simply muse and reflect on what has happened, the sorrow and the shame, and to think about what might be in the future. I nearly gave up several times. It just all seemed too hard, and sometimes it seemed pointless, sometimes it seemed kind of self-indulgent. But how glad I am that I finished the journey and then did a little, what you might call, side trip or coda to the Mile Creek Massacre Memorial, which was a truly life-changing moment. In fact, the whole experience was life-changing of doing this journey. Not to push away the shame and the sorrow of the past that we're part of, but to accept it as actually part of who I am. Not just accept it, actually, but, you know, sit with it. This is part of who I am. Deal with it. Because once you've done that, instead of pushing it away, that then opens the door to going forward into an Australia where perhaps at last we can find justice and an honourable way to move forward together. Thanks very much.
As we've just heard, reconciliation isn't a destination. It's a daily practice of listening, learning, and making space for truths that have been waiting centuries to be fully heard. You're listening to Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Black Child by rapper Birds featuring Moju.
Papa always said, keep your mind on your money and mind your business, cause a white man coming, hunting for the black man, not the brother down. Watch out for the trap, son, no one hears a sound. Sirens all around me, my face to the ground. Bounty on my head, will I make another round? Life is but a luxury in this here lucky country. If you white and got money, ain't no one above thee. Trust me, shit, I'm lucky that my mama loved me. She showed me beauty in a world that's ugly. Damn.
Child, things are gonna get easier.
Oh, my time, fly. Try to make it in this world known as a black child. Oh, my, no
Mama always said, don't be scared, be prepared. Best to know yourself, cause this world ain't fair. Reason why we left there, same thing you see here. Always stand tall, never let them see fear. Nothing really changed, man, just a different town. You're still a black kid when it all go down. See nobody telling me it's better than it was. So my nana's dead buddy and it all came up. How could I know love that I never got to touch? How could she show love? She was forced to give up her black child.
Black child, oh black child, oh black child.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier.
Oh, my time, fly. Try to make it in this world known as a black child.
Oh, my, no lie.
No matter what you do, you'll be known as a black child.
Oh, my time, fly.
Try to make it in this world known as a black child.
Oh,
get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
No matter what you do, you'll be known as a black child.
Oh, my time, fly.
Try to make it in this world known as a black child.
Oh,
that was Birds with Black Child featuring Moju. It comes from his EP, Place of Dreams, and was inspired by his hopes and fears for his own child.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
The process of truth-telling forces many to confront the ghosts in their family tree, the silence in their school textbooks, and the gaps in their understanding of whose country they're standing on. But who does the truth-telling? Who listens? And are we prepared to be uncomfortable enough to change? Because applied truth-telling is not just changing what we know, it's changing who gets to know it, who gets to tell it, who gets believed when they speak. Here's Professor Robin Quiggin again, moderating a conversation recorded at the University of Technology, Sydney.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you. I next invite Professor Lyndon Coombs and Director of Jumbunda Institute for Indigenous Education at UTS, who has, I think, enormous experience in his work here at UTS and enormous experience in this proceeding. So over to you, Lyndon. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. One of the things that I kind of revert to is, I guess, we were talking about what's a project you did where truth-telling was really important, and I'll probably go back to the Collingwood report. Mm. So it's about 5 years on from that, and for those who don't know, we were commissioned by the Collingwood board to look into their history of racist incidents, and one in particular. So there was a former player called Heredia Lumumba who made the claim that he was called Chimp, and this was disputed by the club. And so the board came to us. He was very vocal, very persistent, and the board wanted us to have a look at that and settle it. Resolve the issue once and for all. And we said, that sounds like a workplace investigation. We're not that type of institution, but we will have a look sort of over your history and how you've approached dealing with racism. And that turned into the Collingwood report. And it was such a big thing. It was about truth-telling. So it started with this allegation of being called Chimp, but we went back through Collingwood's history of racism, and what we found was that there was a lack of truth-telling. There was all this defence, prevarication, backpedalling, and Collingwood is the, you know, largest sporting club in the country. It's big, it's influential. Eddie Maguire was the president who held power both within the game and outside. And so I thought, once we were in, I thought, this is going to be bad for me. I don't know how this will end. And it turned out to be good for us. It was a really interesting job. Got to speak to former, current players, former coaches, staff. And what we found, because I had a perception, I had to deal with my own biases as well. So I had a perception of Collingwood as this elite but racist club. So I had to put that aside. And speaking with the people there, they were lovely. You know, they were really good people. They were ashamed of that history and they wanted, you know, to deal with that and they wanted to be better. And so working over that period of time with those people, it was really interesting that we never quite got to the nub of that chimp allegation, but it was subsequently proven. It was actually in a player guide from the time. So, and players after that report came out and said, yes, that was his nickname. We called him that. So being involved in that kind of process, and then part of our recommendation was for them to go and do a truth-telling process of their own, a bit like your experience, but for them to go back through all those incidents, you know, Nicky Widmer pointing at his skin, that was Collingwood. So I guess doing that process and offering and Indigenous people offering their truths to that was really interesting. I note that the club has taken that on board. They've been working really hard at it. But those issues persist. So I guess that was, one of the truth-telling projects that had a big impact on me.
Thank you, Lyndon. I think, yeah. It's one of the reasons I have been so enormously proud to work here at UTS and with Jumbunna, because if you ever wondered how the institutional change occurred that you saw from the outside from in that club, it was, this is the heartland, this engagement of a research team, a structured approach, collaboration as and openness, as Lyndon's talked about, and then a place that institution could no longer sustain. So I just love this story that I've heard Lyndon tell before, and I'm enormously proud to be here in this institution that was part in a kind, respectful way of driving change in one of the institutions that is really formative. I'm no football fan. Like, I am a total failed Aboriginal person that I don't back any team. I'm really terrible at football. Thank you. But football is such a big thing in our community, and to have driven change for a really and shown the way, I feel enormously proud of that story of Lyndon and the others that worked on that team and of that outcome. So thank you for that. Dr. Mariko Smith is a Yuan and Japanese interdisciplinary practitioner and the head of First Nations Collections and Research at the Australian Museum, and more about what institutions and can do bringing the personal and the institutional together. Thank you.
So about me, so Wallawani Ninjiwan. So I have worked across a number of institutions in Sydney. So Australian Museum now as a head of First Nations research and collections. Also spent some time at the Australian National Maritime Museum working with their Indigenous collections, as well as Historic Houses Trust of New South Wales. I still call it by the old name from when I worked over there. Across fields like repatriation, curatorial and collections. And today I will share how museums can engage in truth-telling through a project that challenged how we we understand Australian history and the national story through the Australian Museum's transformation of a 1920s plaster sculpture from an anonymous artefact to a recognised person with family, culture and identity. So looking at museums as colonial institutions and what truth-telling means in that context, museums have historically operated as colonial institutions that collected and displayed First Nations cultural materials and even human remains as scientific specimens and artefacts rather than as the cultural heritage of living people. I have spoken and written about how museums have been complicit in facilitating the collection of people and cultural belongings for empirical evidence used to define and categorise human beings into a hierarchy of superiority and to justify discrimination based on race. Recent community sentiment research conducted by the AM shows how museums are considered as trusted sources of knowledge about First Nations histories, and this is ranked second only to the media, which is also quite a eye-opener. And that creates both responsibility as well as opportunity. Truth-telling in museums means confronting this colonial legacy while creating space for First Nations people to reclaim authority over their own stories. Real truth-telling requires transforming institutional power structures, so not just adding First Nations content to existing colonial frameworks and structures. So that distinction is really important. It's between enacting real societal change as opposed to mere window dressing or, at worst, black cladding. So as an example of applied truth-telling, the Her Name Is Nanny Nelly project at the Australian Museum involved telling the story about, in the mid-1920s, the Australian Museum displayed life-sized plaster sculptures of an Aboriginal woman, Aboriginal man and an Aboriginal boy. And these became, anonymous objects representing a supposedly dying race, as, that myth had been perpetuated, particularly around that time. One sculpture being of an Aboriginal woman displayed without identity, effectively stripping her of her humanity and her family connections. And through collaboration with her descendants and AM staff participating in the family-led documentary, Her Name Is Nanny Nelly, which was directed and produced by Nanny Nelly's own great-great-grandson, Daniel King, we learned that her name is actually Nelly Bunjil Walker, known as affectionately by a family as Nanny Nelly, who was born in 1867 in Bombala, Narigo country. And this documentary and the journey explored her life story. And the project helped transform how she was represented. So from an anonymous object to a named individual, from a scientific curiosity to being recognised as a beloved family ancestor. From perpetuating a dying race narrative to celebrating continuing cultural connections and moving from museum control to Aboriginal family-led, community-led storytelling. And this isn't just about changing a label, a museum label. It was about returning agency to descendants to tell their ancestors' story their way. And the transformation culminated in a 2023 exhibition display in the museum's First Nations Gallery, as well as the release of the documentary on SBS and NITV in early 2024. And this demonstrated how complex historical objects in places like museums, which have that very problematic, loaded history, how these objects can become vehicles for healing and reconciliation. And a few observations of what I felt strongest about during that process. The power of agency. So when someone goes from being anonymous to being, named and acknowledged, recognised for who they were as a person, from being objectified, an objectified thing, to becoming, being seen as a person, and that having direct involvement from those closely connected to that person, that challenges everything about how we understand First Nations people in Australian history. They're not just this footnote and aside or curiosity show; they're actually, front and centre of their own stories. And in terms of overcoming the challenges involved in this truth-telling process, you know, facing up to things like the possibility of institutional resistance, you know, addressing that by centering Indigenous rights as set out by frameworks like the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Indigenous cultural and intellectual property protocols, where it's all about, you know, informed consent and input and self-determining practice being non-negotiable foundations of all work. And then also a really big one is about, yeah, the stereotypes and public misconceptions, how to address those, particularly in our post-referendum environment where people are now, you know, seeing the no result as sort of like a carte blanche now to just say whatever they're thinking that, I guess, normally social norms would probably keep under check. So the museum uses evidence-based approaches, presenting multiple historical sources alongside Indigenous perspectives to build understanding rather than defensiveness. And this is something that's really clear in our previous Unsettled exhibition too. So just to conclude, stories shape nations. This prompts thought and action on how we tell stories in museums, how they shape the ways Australians understand themselves and their history. And truth-telling in museums, that requires them to move beyond token acknowledgements to fundamental transformation by returning authority over Indigenous stories to Indigenous peoples. When we transform how one person is represented, we begin to transform how our nation understands its relationship with First Nations peoples. And finally, this is the power of applied truth-telling, changing not just what we know, but how we know it and who has the authority to tell the story. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone. Such, so great to have give everybody the opportunity to speak to their particular work and practice. We move now to some panel questions, and I'm going to begin with a question for Lorena, Lyndon and Mariko. You've all reflected on this in some way, but the question is, if truth-telling is this opportunity to share experiences, particularly the strengths and deep knowledge of First Peoples of this country, how does this impact on the individuals and communities during the truth-telling process? Any reflections on what happens for people and communities through the through this process?
Yeah, so this is something we've talked about. So one of our projects at the moment is as a research partner with the New South Wales Treaty Commissioners. So they've been given the remit to go out over 12 months and speak exclusively to Aboriginal people in New South Wales about treaty. That's all it is. It's a conversation. Do you want it? Do you know what it is? It's a conversation. And then after 12 months, there'll be a report, and there's no sort of guarantee that anything will really come of that. And we've spoken a lot about, you know, not being extractive in these processes so that you leave these engagements better than when you went there. And the other thing that's really on the commissioners' minds and all of our minds was, here we go, we're asking Aboriginal people to dust themselves off, show up again, tell their story that they've told before, and what are they going to get in return? And so that's a big obligation that they've got when going out there. So we've talked a lot about social emotional well-being, and I'm really glad that that's becoming, you know, more of a priority in all of our work, particularly for our staff and the work that they do. So, yeah, that truth-telling, like we experienced yesterday, it comes with a cost. It does, and I've, you know, probably old enough now to be vulnerable enough to say that, you know, this stuff takes a toll. That yesterday really, had an impact. So that has an impact for all of our people out there, you know, whether it's treaty, whether it's housing, health, education of our kids, all these stories come with a bit of a price. And, you know, yeah, I might leave it there. I was going to talk about Simona.
I really identify with that. There is great value in the opportunity to tell our stories, but they always come with the emotions. We are not detached from the emotions that come with that. And I think that's a great strength of ours, and it also does come with a cost. Look, Lorena or Mariko, did you want to respond to that?
Community opportunity, yes.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to, in response to that, I really underscore what Lyndon just said, because when people think about truth-telling, they think it's us doing the telling. Mm. And I think it's time for non-Indigenous Australians to do a bit of work before they come to us and ask us what the time frame should be, and, you know, ask us to expend our labour, because there's been so much truth-telling in Australian history that even recent years that has fallen on deaf ears. Well, not so much deaf ears, but, you know, we work hard, we create these really important reports that sit on a shelf. I think Glendra knows we were involved in the Bringing Them Home report, all the public hearings, all the evidence gathering, all the heartache and trauma that we saw our people go through literally day after day for that phase, all those people who took the courage to speak up. And we think about them and what happens when they went home afterwards. There were the support networks that have to be set up for our mob to tell these truths, and those support networks need to be run by Indigenous people, Indigenous psychologists and psychiatrists. There needs to be support. I know we have the hotline, but if we're going to do this work, we need to protect our people, particularly our elderly people who lived through these times and who might really want to tell their story, but we've got to make sure that we listen and collect that information in a respectful, caring way, and it might take a really long time before we get it. We are able to do that, but I think the work needs to be done by non-Indigenous Australians the way that Kate has done, and it's really difficult work, but doing a bit of that work before you come talk to us would be helpful too.
Thank you, Marika.
And so, like, with truth-telling with sensitivity, and particularly when you're engaging with contested histories, it's it's about recognizing for both the communities who are directly impacted and involved in that particular in that history, but as well as the people who are learning the lesson and taking it in. I mean, everyone to an extent needs to be prepared for sitting with discomfort. It's, not all stories will be comfortable for all audiences, but it's really critical about providing the appropriate context and support. So support for people telling that story, but also for those who are listening as well, and having that sort of space, physical as well as more of a sort of intellectual space as well to reflect. So that's something we did in the Unsettled exhibition at the Australian Museum, where it was a really tough going with all the truth-telling about Australian social history. And it was really important that while people were learning and taking it all in from the community as well as from the general public, that they weren't just kind of pushed out into, the main area of the museum and out into streets with no way to really digest what they've just seen and heard and learnt about. So it was really important to create a physical space where people can just sit quietly, and we created this space called Wanunga Dirinya, which is a Wiradjuri word which means deep listening, meditation, and just being able to listen and learn quietly. And so there was a space that Milan Dian, which is a Wiradjuri group that does a lot of cultural learning and sharing. They had some recorded cultural lessons that would play in the space, and there was like a circle where people can sit down. And so that is really important because we're not about sanitising difficult histories for visitor comfort, but at the same time we're taking that responsibility seriously for community members, but also the public. And that was a real highlight for many visitors with Unsettled, and I think it really, does help us redefine, museum exhibition design and curation, but we need to create these spaces to help with truth-telling in that sort of spatial sense as well as the content.
Thank you. Thank Kate, as somebody who you described your own process of going and reflecting, and I guess quite an experiential process, not everybody's willing to or wants to do that. From the perspective as a non-Indigenous person who has undertaken that work, do you have any suggestions? What kinds of questions can people ask themselves, or what kind of research or reflections can people do to start interrogating their own histories in connections to First Peoples land and First Peoples?
Yes, it's a good question, because it's not easy. It's, you know, we've hidden it for so long, and it's tempting to go on just saying, oh, it was so long ago, we have to just move on. But I think the first thing is to get informed. I think, Lorena, you talked about kind of doing your homework before anything else. And there are now such a wealth of fantastic, I mean, you can start with books, which is a very unconfronting way of starting. They're, you know, at a distance, you can always close them. Many, many terrific Indigenous written stories about our past, and also the kind of, you know, mainstream historians like Henry Reynolds and Bill Gammage. So, you know, to do the homework, first of all, I think is the thing. And then to listen to First Nations people, obviously, in person, when and how that's possible. But not perhaps to, you know, when I wrote Unsettled, I was very conscious that I could have gone everywhere and contacted the local Aboriginal people and said, oh, you know, let's talk about this. And I thought, no, this is a job that we have to do. It's kind of our problem. We created this problem by, you know, colonising this country. It's not fair that we should ask that of Indigenous people. And it is asking them basically to revisit the trauma that we have visited on them. So I think we have to go very carefully, and I just think that there's an awful lot of work we have to do first in kind of sitting with not rushing to an answer. I think that's perhaps the other thing. Sitting with it, reflecting on it, just allowing a quiet space of meditation before we try to rush into any answers.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate. I want to come back, Lyndon, to, I know you have a deep commitment to treaty and the potential for that for our country, our states, our federally and state. I'm wondering, through your experience with and your observations with the Yurok Commission, and also your experience in New South Wales, what your reflections might be on the role of truth-telling for any treaty process that we might keep moving with here in New South Wales?
Yeah, thanks. I had probably a very late awakening on part of truth-telling, you know, doing some of this work and different work, because I'd often heard more older Aboriginal people that, you know, had got to a stage in their life where they wanted to tell things that happened, and that reflects, you know, the policies and history of the country, and that they had always wanted to tell that story, because if everyone knew what happened, then everyone would get it. Everyone would understand why we have poor health, why we're impoverished, why we want a treaty, why, you know, we're different. And I wasn't always convinced of that. But in some of the truth-telling, my late awakening was that it's not for everyone else, it's for us. And in doing that, and particularly the work around treaty, it was that that's for us to talk to each other about, to tell our truths to each other, and then maybe we'll tell everyone else. And it was a real moment for me that this is a fundamental part of our healing over this journey. And that's why, yeah, it's interesting the way, Mariko, you sort of managed that. And that's an ongoing thing for us in, you know, so much of our work is how we look after our people. You know, people derive safe spaces as being woke, but it's fundamental. It's very, you know, big for our mob. And I'm really, like I was saying, that conversation around social and emotional well-being, I'm really proud that we recognise our humanity in that way and pretend, you know, that doesn't bother me. You know, I spent a lot of my career pretending I had a thicker skin than I did as a means of sort of protection. But the way that we talk about that now, I think, shows the way for the country more broadly.
Noreen, I mean, quiet, a little rest over there, but not now. You really interrogate how language and narratives are ultimately contributing to our understanding. What are your reflections on the use of language and framing used in today's storytelling, journalism and other media? Are we doing any better, do you think, or has there been any change? Has there been a shift? It mightn't be for the better, but any shift that you noticed?
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the way the Western liberal media are reporting the situation in Gaza, you can see how they hide behind language, won't use the right language, language that actually describes what's going on there. And that's certainly been the case in Australian history and the history of Australian journalism. When Lyndall Ryan and I started talking about adapting that work for The Guardian, what it entailed was that I had to read through every single entry on that map to sub it in a way that it could be imported into the Guardian system. And so I got a sense of the horrors that she and her team had been dealing with. But it was also a really instructive exposure to the way that the language was used to eradicate our people and to take away our agency and to remove our connection to country. So there were words like major so-and-so took up the land, you know, it was just took it up, it was just there. Reading journals of colonial frontiers, people who dispersed the natives, it was land clearing. There are all sorts of unpleasant euphemisms that they used, even then knowing that what they were doing was a crime. To paper over the atrocity using language and the power that language has to do that. And so part of truth-telling today is to reinterpret those journals and to take away the fig leaf of respectability from what is truly a horrific admission of mass murder.
That was award-winning journalist Lorena Allam speaking alongside Professor Robin Quiggin and author Kate Grenville. Lorena's words echo an urgent truth. We must speak true words wherever and whenever we can. She was joined in conversation by Kate Grenville, Dr. Mariko Smith and Professor Lyndon Coombs. The conversation was moderated by Professor Robin Quiggin. That's the show for this week. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaea Gibbs-Muir. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our titter show Away, hosted by the fabulous Rudy Bremer. This week, she is discussing the purpose of protest with Bridget Karma from the Uluru Youth Dialogue. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.